in the matter of State versus Marcus McCroy Davis. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Robin Lord on behalf of Mr. McCroy Davis.
Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey on behalf of both the ACLU and the Office of the Public Defender as friends of the court.
For the amicus American, strike that, Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in New Jersey, David White, Pashman Stein, Walder Hayden.
Good morning. Assistant Burlington County Prosecutor Jennifer Paskowitz on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Deputy Attorney General Lauren Bonfiglio for the Attorney General.
Chief Assistant Prosecutor John McNamara, Jr., on behalf of the County Prosecutor's Association in New Jersey. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Lord.
Thank you.
You need a pad.
Give me just a second. Here. Here.
Please.
May it please the court. May I respectfully reserve a few minutes rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. The judiciary, as noted earlier, will again resume criminal jury trials in person when conditions sufficiently improve. Although there will be a considerable backlog of cases to address, we hope that recent positive developments will enable the criminal justice system to resolve many outstanding criminal charges in a timely manner. That was this court, February 11, 2021, in In Re Detainees. The statistics cited by this court in 2021 included the fact that there were 4,937 detainees, pretrial detainees. March 11, 2022, as cited by the Prosecutors Association in their certification, there were 6,232 detainees, a difference of 1,295 more individuals detained, presumed innocent, in the county jails awaiting trial.
Can you keep your voice up a little bit?
Sure, sorry. It's true what they say about lawyers and math, as far as I'm concerned. So I asked Siri, and it's 26% increase. That's huge. That's absolutely huge. Over 1,000 individuals have been detained more in just one calendar year. Welcome to our backlog. So the issue becomes, what do we do about it? We have an act that puts an outer limit of 2 years, and we have a backlog that says your chances of getting a trial within 2 years are slim to nil. So what do? I respectfully suggest that in the context of the errors made in the trial court here below, that this court has the power to craft a reasonable balance that honors the spirit of the CJRA. Let's discuss those errors if we can. There are two excludable time orders that the court entered below. One, September 17th, 21, to November 14th, 21, and the other, November 15th, 21, to April 22nd, 22. We appeared before the court on September 17th. When we appeared before the court on September 17th, we were told we had a trial date of January 25th. At that time, the state made an application for excludable time. I said, wait a second, put it in writing, give me the opportunity to respond, and the court so directed. November, we appear in court, November 15th. No application by the state, no motion by the state, no brief, no opportunity to respond, and we learned something new, that there is a superseded indictment. When we were in court in September, no mention at all that they were seeking a superseding indictment. But they did. So they sought a superseded indictment, and we enter our appearance not guilty on the superseded indictment, and the court goes right in, the trial court goes right in, and he indicates at the inception that I'm being advised that there will be excludable time from today's date to the new trial date, attributable to the court for extenuating circumstances. So I think you could tell by my surprise, I'm like, wait, what? You know, at first I thought I couldn't hear him because of the mask. So what we had here was a situation where the prosecutor clearly said that we need more time because they wanted excludable time. They don't give us a hint in September that they're going to seek a superseding indictment. They seek a superseding indictment, and they start off the colloquy saying, well, after the judge says he's going to give excludable time, and I'm like, based on what? They're like, well, we can restart the clock because we got a superseding indictment. My position was, no, you can't. There are certain factors that the court has to take into consideration. And we have a discussion for 7 pages, and it goes on and on and on. And the court ends up granting excludable time, or ordering, I don't say granting, because it was not even an application by the state, sua sponte, ordering excludable time. And the reasons for it are exceptional circumstances and good cause due to courtroom availability and COVID-19. Okay, well, let's digest that for a second. September 17th, 21, to November 14th, 21, there were two orders. One was retroactive and one was prospective. As far as the retroactive order is concerned, where was the reason for the delay? Where was the courtroom availability issue? I mean, I was there in September. I could have been there in October, November. I was there. The defendant was there. The court was there. There was no unavailable court. There wasn't a trial date that I asked for a continuance. We were there. We were available. We were ready to proceed. So I don't understand. It's not supported by the basis to retroactively grant the excludable time from September to November. It's just not there. Excuse me. The November 15th prospective. So what happens November 15th? We no longer have a trial date of January 25th. It's changed to April 22nd. Okay. None of us knew. We learned for the first time. And now we're getting excludable time from November 15th to the trial date of April 22nd, 6 months in advance. The issue here is how can a court possibly grant excludable time prospectively because of unavailability of a courtroom 6 months in advance? You just can't do it. If, it brings us to the first issue I suggest the court has the opportunity to address, if courtroom availability is a recognized exceptional circumstance that can constitute excludable time, it cannot be assessed 6 months in advance. The appropriate procedure would be list the case for trial, which it did January 25th, let us appear. Is there a courtroom available? Is there not a courtroom available? Is a prosecutor available? Is a defense available? Is the judge otherwise in trial? And if, you know, they're not available, then you have a real assessment as to courtroom availability. You can't prospectively guess or speculate or conject that in 6 months from now we're going to have a courtroom available. The fluid nature of trials, especially considering this backlog, it's crazy. I mean, I've been in trial. I think I'm on my third or fourth trial post-pandemic, and every single one has not concluded in a verdict. The first one was a mistrial in the middle because of prosecutor turning over discovery. The second one, again, discovery issue. We pled out in the middle of the trial. The third one, we pled before trial. The fourth one, I'm in now. So you can't detain a presumed innocent defendant. Someone, according to Justice Marshall in Salerno, I forget how he articulates it, but it's brilliant. Of course, I can't remember it now. But it's, you know, they're legally, the allegations are legally presumed to be untrue. Allegations of all these individuals are legally presumed to be untrue. We're keeping him in jail, prospectively saying, okay, your time is up according to the act, but we're going to give you a trial date 6 months down the road. It can't be done that way. It just can't be done that way. And what happened in this case? P.S., I'm in trial. April 22nd, McCroy Davis did not go to trial because I'm in trial on a case that took precedent because it was a remand. So, I mean, if we're really going to honor the CJRA, we have to impose respectfully guidelines for these courts to follow so we're not unnecessarily detaining these individuals as they're doing it.
So you began your remarks by speaking about the balance that we need to find for the circumstances that exist right now as we continue to deal with the effects of COVID. Step back from this case. Tell us what your understanding of the law is. If we reach a point where the attorney for the state stands up and says, I'm ready to proceed, but there is indeed no courtroom available that can accommodate with social distancing and the precautionary measures that are being taken throughout the judiciary. There is no courtroom that can accommodate the trial at the end of that two-year mark. What should happen to that defendant?
So that's a real problem, as I'm sure Your Honors recognize. It's a real problem because our act, the federal bail, under Salerno, the Federal Bail Act was deemed not unconstitutional because the statute gave a maximum period, as opposed to an indefinite period of incarceration. Here, we are subjected to an indefinite period of incarceration simply because the standard is, as you identified, prosecutorial readiness. All a prosecutor has to do is say they're ready, and then the statute is completely silent as to what happens next. So the purpose of the act was not to get the prosecutor.
Help us understand. I'm asking you, because you begin by saying we wanted to find the right balance. Okay. What is the right balance?
The right balance is, as I respectfully proposed, if everything is in line, if there's not available, if the prosecutor is sufficiently met the prosecutor readiness, because I have an issue with respect to what is prosecutorial readiness, there has to be an outer limit. There has to be an outer limit. I proposed it for first and second degree violent offenders, 60 days. First and second degree nonviolent offenders, additional 30 days. There just has to be some outer limit so we no longer have situations where we give a trial date months in advance and the poor defendant doesn't go to trial because of, you know, the stars are not in a line for him on that day. And I think...
This case was scheduled to go to trial last week, though, was it
yes,
not?
Yes, yes.
And why didn't it?
Because I found myself in trial in another matter in Camden County, which I'm currently involved, which is an older case. That case is from 2018. It was a remand from, I believe it was this court. It was a motion to withdraw a plea, and then it was granted, and it was remanded for trial. So it took precedent.
Are there any other reasons why this case didn't go to trial?
Are there any other reasons why
this case... Any outstanding motions in this case?
There is a motion being heard on Friday, a motion to sever, yes, which was...
When was that motion filed?
That motion was filed within the last month, within the last couple of weeks. I came in possession of a letter from the co-defendant. The co-defendant gave my client a letter indicating that he's not responsible and he wants to testify for my client, so I made a motion to sever for him to go first and me to go second so he can testify against us at trial, and that's being heard on Friday.
So that was 2 years after the indictment?
Yes. Yes.
Were there older cases than yours in Burlington County? But you've mentioned that there is an incredible backlog.
Yes.
And that is all accountable to the pandemic. Some case has to go before another case.
Correct.
Are there like older cases than yours in the county that would take precedence for the same reason that you're currently trying a case?
Yes.
And not available for this one?
Yes, absolutely. Here's the problem with respect to the pandemic and the protocol countywide. If I'm in Monmouth County, they try five cases at a clip because of the space. If you're in Burlington County, you try one case at a time. If you're a multiple co-defendant case, I think it's only recently they're doing two defendants, and three defendants, you know, good night, Irene, you're not going to trial for a long time. Unless there's no protocols and it's not 3 feet apart and they're not sitting, the jurors aren't sitting in the back and we have to sit, you know, space 3 feet apart. So,
The reason why I asked that question, because I'm trying to understand the predicament in Burlington County. I'm trying to get my head around it. Because you're saying, okay, I'm like ready to go, but how many other people have stood up and said, I'm ready to go?
So,
do you know?
Well, I do know, to answer Your Honor's question, I do know one thing, and it was something that was learned, and it was a little disturbing to me last week, and that was a concession, actually, to my colleague from Judge Breland, and that is that they have tried more street cases this year than detained cases, which I thought was sad, quite frankly. And the
Does
reason
that reflect the fact that detained cases have been put up and have pled, and as a result of summoning a jury, they've moved on to other cases, or is there some other reason?
What was represented is because they're easier to try, because you don't have to bother with writs and getting defendants with the cooperation of the correctional facility and so forth. Made no sense to me. Makes absolutely no sense to me. Defendants, absolutely.
But you're not aware. You can't tell us as you stand there, I would imagine, whether detained cases, counsel had been told, show up for trial, and that case may have resolved itself prior to the trial date.
Well, yeah, mine was one of them in January. Carrie Green, which was a remand from this court, conviction got reversed, and instead of, because we had a real trial date, we played out to the functional equivalent of time served. I mean, you need these trial dates to move these cases. I mean, if you have all day, I can give you my opinion as to how we can move cases, and one, of course, is revising the rule that allows the trial court to participate in plea discussions. You know, as we stand here today, you have to have the prosecutor's permission. If you remove that caveat, 50% of these cases are going away. I mean, I kid you not. Judges are dying to move these cases.
May I ask you one more question about this particular case and the delays here? The new motion that was filed, was there a basis for filing that motion earlier than it was filed? There's a bit of an irony here. We're talking about having a speedy trial in this case, and yet we have motions filed years after the indictment. So I'm looking for an explanation as to why the timing for that motion is what it is.
Because the co-defendant just gave the letter to my client, and the client just gave it to me, and I immediately filed a motion to sever.
I accept your representation. Was there a basis to know this might be in the offing prior to the letter actually being tendered?
Was there a basis to know? You know, there's always, with co-defendant cases, you know, the suggestion, but you can't have more than a suggestion that, you know, someone's will get on the witness stand and exonerate you. That gets you no place under Sanchez for a motion to sever. You have to have a real basis. But was there a suggestion in this case? I wasn't aware of any. All I know is when I had the piece of paper, within a reasonable period of time, I filed a motion to sever. The statute, as far as prosecutor readiness is concerned, I mean, the purpose of the CJRA is not to get a prosecutor ready. It's to move a case quicker. But when your sole mechanism of determining whether a case is tried is prosecutor readiness, end of story, we can keep them indefinitely, it's inconsistent with the spirit and policy of the CJRA. I think that there needs to be an adjustment. Like we talked about how it's silent as to what happens next. You have to step back and keep in mind what the purpose of the CJRA is, and that is to move cases closer, defendants to trial, as opposed to getting a prosecutor ready, although it certainly helps if they're ready. And I have a whole issue with respect to what is prosecutor readiness. It shouldn't just be a lip service of representation, we're ready. Every single case that I've tried, with the exception of the one I'm in right now, there was an issue regarding discovery since the pandemic. Discovery. Just 66 witnesses' names were given to me in Camden County. In the middle of trial in Monmouth County, I learned through cross-examination they had a huge deal with the cooperating witness.
Are you saying anything? We have a case before us in which you've made the application. Are you saying there was an issue with prosecutor readiness in this case?
Yes, I'll talk about that. The reason I mentioned the discovery, though, is because we're talking about prosecutor readiness, and there has to be a meaningful prosecutor readiness, which includes an assessment as to whether we
do
the discovery.
I understand, but okay. In terms of anecdotes regarding other cases, it's hard for us to assess. We have no record on those cases. What happened here?
So what happened here is that the judge, Judge Breland made an order in November without any assessment of prosecutor readiness. And he gave us a trial date of April. There was a trial date of January 25th and a release date of January 3rd. Unbeknownst to any of us, court staff listed the January 3rd date. My associate just happened to be in the courthouse. She appears. There is that brief transcript on the record. And there's an inquiry by a court staff, is the prosecutor ready? And the answer is, in April, yes, I'll be ready. It isn't, I'm ready today. That doesn't satisfy prosecutor readiness in any way, shape, or form.
I've looked at that transcript. I'm not so certain. Yes, the prosecutor said that she'd be ready, or he would be ready by April 22nd, but it was a little vaguer than that. I mean, the prosecutor was not suggesting that the state was not ready at that moment to proceed with the case. I didn't divine that from reading the entire transcript, which isn't very long. It's only 5 pages.
The order on appeal, though, is what happened in November, and they already gave an April 22nd date. So whether the prosecutor's ready in January is really not the issue, although it should have been. As I indicated, that to determine prosecutor readiness and courtroom availability, it should be on the release date. You should have a real meaningful release hearing.
Okay, so one of the points you're making is that at the two-year mark, when the prosecutor says that he or she is ready, they should be ready on that date. That's the two-year mark. Okay, so maybe the question has to be posed really specific. You ready now? And assuming that the prosecutor says, ready now, is that going to satisfy you, or do you want more?
The problem is you can't give lip service to ready now when you know there's no courtroom to try it and you have an April trial date.
So it's
an illusion.
What should happen under those circumstances? What should a judge do after the prosecutor stands up and says, ready to go?
So there should be, it's multifaceted, okay? So there should be a meaningful release hearing. His release date was January 3rd. It should have been scheduled for a release hearing. We appear, we address it. What do you address at a release hearing? Number one, is the prosecutor ready? And what do you mean by ready, Madam Prosecutor? Did you contact your witnesses? Are they available? Is discovery been reviewed? Do you have any motions pending? A real meaningful assessment as to prosecutor availability. The second segues into, okay, court availability. Is there a courtroom ready to try? And if the courtroom is not ready to try, we don't give it a four-month or five-month trial date down the road. You give it a trial date within short intervals, and you revisit it. The prosecutor readiness should not be static. It should be a continuity of assessments as time goes on. The courtroom availability should not be static or fixed down the road, 6 months down the road. It should be an assessment. These are real human beings that are being detained on a hope and a prayer that they'll get to their trial date 6 months after we've promised them you're going to only be in jail for 2 years, absent excludable time attributable to you. So that's what I respectfully believe should happen at a release hearing, because, again, no guidance in the statute at all as to what should happen at a release hearing. There has to be something meaningful to otherwise not gut the CJRA. I hope I answered that question. Do you have any other questions?
No. Look, on January 3rd, the prosecutor was told that the trial date is set for April 22nd. The prosecutor said, yeah, I'm ready. Right. But that didn't suggest that the prosecutor wasn't ready on January 3rd. We just don't,
There's no record.
Yeah, we don't have a record.
There's not a record of it. And the prosecutor didn't have to be ready on January 3rd because the judge told him in November, granted excludable time, thinking he could, and they've all conceded that it was erroneous. You can't grant excludable time moving to 2 years. I mean, they conceded that was wrong. That was wrong. He can't do that. And that's what he did. And that's what we're appealing. So the prosecutor readiness is a red herring, so to speak, because it really has nothing to do with the issues before this court and the order that we're appealing before this court. The other thing that I have, with respect to the sua sponte aspect of granting the excludable time. So we came out of the box on November 15th, and he just starts out, the court started, as I indicated, with there's going to be excludable time based upon availability of the court, and then there was the colloquy. So there was no application for excludable time, although there was previously in September, and they ordered to file a brief, as I indicated, and they didn't. But here is the court making a significant determination, which means, by the way, we're detaining this individual, this presumed innocent individual. I am sua sponte making a determination that I'm going to detain this person on my own without giving defense counsel notice or opportunity to be heard. I mean, that's the reason I asked for it to be briefed in September. But now, out of the box, he's saying I'm granting excludable time. I mean, that's in violation of due process.
Isn't the heart of the issue as to sua sponte whether there was a legitimate basis for what the judge did? Does the statute somewhere prohibit a judge from entering a sua sponte order?
So I think respectfully that it does because of the constitutional implications behind it. Because he or she is making a significant impact or difference in a liberty interest of an individual. And that's a significant jump. What Your Honors did for the omnibus orders, absent no in-person juries, which you have no other choice but to grant excludable time, absent in a pandemic-like, a natural disaster situation, there has to be notice to a defendant, an opportunity to be heard and address it. So the court could say, well, what unavailability? How do you know in November that you're unavailable? You didn't give me a trial date till.
So if the argument pivots off of the sua sponte nature of the order, then why aren't the court's orders themselves?
I'm sorry, I'm here.
Then why aren't the omnibus orders that the court entered into sua sponte invalid?
So they're not invalid because what I indicated previously is that you have no, the whole purpose of the speedy trial is to get the person to trial. If you have no trials, if you pause in-person jury trials, then this court has the authority, or any court has the authority, to issue because it's a natural disaster.
So you've taken us to the basis for the order. And I think that's the stronger argument that can be advanced. Look at why the judge did what the judge did, not whether the judge was the first to speak and then say to counsel, what do you say about that? But whether there is support for the order that was entered.
I take that position as well. And of course, my position is there was no support because we're speculating 6 months down the road. Well, there's withdrawn. There's nothing in the record to say why we couldn't try this case in November, December, January, February, March, or April. There's nothing in the record to say why he made an assessment that the courtroom will now be unavailable until April.
Did you make those challenges before Judge Breland?
I was taken, no, the answer is no. I was taken aback, and I mean, I think you could tell by some of my comments. I'm like, what are you doing here? Like, I thought we were ready to trial. You're giving me a 6-month down the road trial date.
I understand.
And then I'm here.
You're a very able advocate. So the judge issues a sua sponte order, and you think it's inappropriate. There's nothing stopping you from challenging it and to say, I want to be heard on this. I think that order is wrong.
But
go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
It's your last day, so maybe you should be interrupted. No, just kidding.
But I don't want to have the last word, so you go ahead.
So I think I challenged him.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you read the transcript, you know, I said, well, what's the basis? I mean, it was just going to leave it as is. I'm like, well, what's the basis? I want to take an appeal. There needs to be some guidance. I want to come to the Supreme Court. Here I am. Thank you very much. Hopefully we'll have some guidance. And I do believe respectfully, Justice Albin, that I did challenge it by coming here and joining and bringing company. Because we're drowning.
No, we're happy to have you here. Don't get it. But I'm asking specifically the court. I mean, that's the first place you make the challenge. You're making points right now that seems sensible enough. Like, why can't we go now? Is there a courtroom available? In the first instance, all those arguments should be made to the trial court. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't believe I respectfully disagree as applied to what happened here. And the reason is because I believe that the record, I was still trying to wrap my head around, are we doing this for superseded indictment? Are we doing this for, and he didn't even call it extraordinary, he called it
an exception. Why is this an exception? Normally you make applications to the trial court and on scheduling, which is as to which the trial court has a tremendous amount of discretion, that is an application that generally is made to the trial court first. Why is this different? Why make arguments? Let me ask you as a factual matter, did you make the same arguments before the trial court that you're making today?
No.
So why is this different from any other application on procedural issues and criminal trials all the time, where the expectation is that you make an application for the trial court and the trial court can deal with it at that time?
Because State versus Cahill and others talk about how a defendant doesn't have to take himself to trial. Here I am being given an order saying I'm not going to trial. It's beyond, they're moving my release date, and my application is release me.
But your application before this court is that what was done in your case violates the act. That's
correct.
Your application. And that doesn't appear to have been an argument raised before the trial court.
I think in spirit it was raised.
In spirit?
Yes. I mean, there was a discussion about superseding indictments, and I'm like, what is the extenuating circumstances?
You're making statutory arguments, and you're making constitutional arguments based upon what happened before the trial court, and it seems that those arguments are being made for the first time here.
They are, and they're not. The statute is black and white. You can't move me because of excludable time, not attributable to me. My release date has come and gone. Release me. I think that's the issue, and he should have been released on January the 3rd.
Unless, of course, the court, and your position is, unless, of course, the prosecutor truly established he was ready, provided the record to establish he was ready, and there were courtrooms available.
Yes.
Or unavailable. So, let's assume that happened. Let's assume the trial court said, well, prosecutor, explain why you're ready. Are the subpoenas out? Are the witnesses available? And he does. And he says, but I've got this information from our staff. We won't have a courtroom until April because of all these trials that are older than yours, and they've got to go to trial. Blah, blah. Would that have been enough? Would that obviate the need to be here?
No. Because there needs to be some guidelines and some guidance from this court to the trial courts who are swimming uphill without a paddle, literally, because of the backlog, as to can I schedule a trial 4 months down the road? Do I have to carry it periodically on a shorter period of time so I can assess the true meaning? Because I was talking about
So that's the issue. Let's assume all that happened. The trial court should have said, all right, we'll put it on hold, and as soon as the courtroom's available, we're going to go. We'll give you a week's notice. We're going to go. That would have been a resolution.
Except, how long are we waiting?
All right, hold on. And if the first time that court was available was in April, still, we're not here on this argument. They kept postponing it a week, and finally, all right, we've got a courtroom, no older cases, we're ready to go, and it's April. That we wouldn't be here today.
So if you look at the statute, right, and or actually it's the court rule, regarding moving 180 days, you can only move it for 60 days. I think it's in violation of the spirit and policy intent of the statute and the court rule to move it 6 months or 4 months. When if they moved for moving 180, they asked for more time under 180, the most they can do is grant for 60 days. So you're talking about 6 months. So it's inherently limiting by the language of the rule itself.
Does that mean if the courtroom's not available for 60 days, he gets released at that time?
Yes. Okay. Yes. That would be my position. There has to be an outer limit. So you talked about in Ray, right, about case-by-case basis analysis. You can't do that here. There's 6,000 pretrial detainees. Now, granted, all of them are not going to go to trial and so forth, but case-by-case basis, and then you don't give us, respectfully, there is no avenue as a right to appeal. So we have to hope, you know, that the appellate division, in this case, the appellate division didn't grant leave, grants leave and gives us an opinion regarding that. If we're going to do that, we need an appeal as of right if we're going to talk about the release dates, which segues me into the appeal issue. A defendant can't be penalized for appealing, being kept in jail too long. If you want to appeal, if a defendant wants to appeal for excludable time, he can't be penalized if he loses because the orders are just not appealable. So I would respectfully urge this court to find that that's an exception. The Washington case, which unfortunately was mine, is entirely different because we couldn't do anything below in Washington while it was on appeal. Here, if the case is pending appeal on excludable time, the proceedings are not interfered with. They can still proceed as they are. I'm arguing a motion, like I said on Friday, for a motion to sever. So there has to be some carve-out for no excludable time for appealing for excludable time. It's just fundamentally unfair any other way.
What if there are repetitive motions for leave to appeal, all of which in the end have no basis, no merit?
Should it
defend? And that's pushing it out towards the two-year mark. Then you want that two-year mark to be a hard and fast line and say, not my fault. Is that going to be the argument?
I don't have at my fingertips the statistics of who's appealing and how often they're appealing. I just know based upon what I've been doing, I feel like I'm alone in a lot of these appeals.
But you're asking us to make a universal rule for everyone, not just for yourself.
Agreed. But the point I'm making is that I don't believe that it's going to create a situation where unnecessary litigation is all of a sudden going to happen. And I don't think a defendant should be, I mean, we're talking about a liberty interest, keeping him in jail longer than the 2 years, presumed innocent, and so forth. And so if you want to appeal keeping him in jail, I don't know how that can ever be frivolous, other than something he did, which would be attributable to him, right? So then it wouldn't be attributable to the court or the prosecution. I know we're speculating here, but I don't think a defendant should be penalized because he gets a bad ruling in the appellate court. The way it's set up now, the interpretation, it's not, Your Honors haven't ruled on it, but the only way it's set up now is by penalizing us if we get a bad ruling, like right now. The only reason we appealed is because we had excludable time until April 22nd, so it's no harm, no foul. Hopefully it won't take too long.
I don't know that we should think of it in terms of penalizing the defendant. There's a hard and fast two-year rule. And the question is, should the defendant be released? if the defendant is responsible for the delays.
Well, then it's not, there's...
And I'm not saying that the motions can be in good faith, but they're one of the reasons why the case isn't perhaps moving as fast as it should.
Okay, so I will concede that I'm okay with a suggested compromise, and that is if the appellate court rules that the delay was attributable to the defendant, then he doesn't get excludable time towards the 2 years. So that, I think, is consistent with the intent and purpose of the statute.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you just said.
You said
he doesn't get excludable time if the defendant is responsible for the delay.
Your release of 2 years, if calculating all the excludable time, not attributable to the defendant. So if there's a decision in the appellate court or this court that it's attributable to the defendant,
and that doesn't count toward the excludable time.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
So that would be on a case by case basis that the appellate court would make a determination, you know, piggybacking off of Justice Alvin's question, if there's a defendant that's making tons of potentially frivolous motions with regard to excludable time, the appellate court could make a determination that this excludable time is attributable to the defendant. Is that what you're...
So, yes, Your Honor. In my mind, I'm just thinking how it could be frivolous. So it could be frivolous one of two ways. Frivolous, number one, because we're responsible, the defendant's responsible. But then, of course, he shouldn't be penalized because he's responsible and he's not getting excludable time anyway. Or is it frivolous because there's no courtroom availability and I still want out? So, I mean, that, with respect to that aspect, the latter, that's more compelling and we shouldn't be penalized. Please let us out, please let us out. I hope I answered your question.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I'm not sure about the propriety of this, but I just want to wish Justice Alvin well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to assume that everybody wants to do so. You're all noted for the record right now.
Objection.
Mr. Schultz. Duly noted.
May it please the court. Justice Patterson, I'm mindful of your earlier questioning about the fact that we're dealing with a particular case and the particular facts of it, but I'm also mindful of the fact that this is the court's first opportunity to deal with this critically important portion of the CJRA, and that historically, as this court has dealt with CJRA cases, it has understood the important recurring impact they have.
Certainly, I absolutely understand that wasn't my point. My point was that talking about other cases not before the court anecdotally,
of course,
hard for us with no record.
I say that only to suggest that on behalf of the ACLU and the OPD, I'm going to try and zoom out a little bit and talk about three broad issues. My friend from the County Prosecutors Association kind of framed out the way the statute works, and I think did so correctly, which is to say, and this gets to something we were talking about, excludable time, and there are, 15 different bases for excludable time, only applies to the 90-day and the 180-day limit. On the other hand, we have this 2-year limit, which is kind of stopped by prosecutorial readiness and expanded by delays attributable to the defendant. That is the framework under which we're working. And within that framework, I'd like to talk about three areas where I disagree with my friends on the other side. And those are whether and to what extent the pandemic-related closures constitute the extraordinary exceptional circumstances under 2A.162.22b1f. Then I want to talk about a little bit how we measure prosecutorial readiness. And then I also want to talk about the appeal issue that defense counsel just raised. So starting with exceptional circumstances, I think there can be no debate that the omnibus orders issued by this court when there were no juries happening were a proper application of B1F. That is the definition of an exceptional circumstance. I think the question, the tricky question, is to what extent the backlog that emanated from that counts as exceptional circumstances. And Justice Alban, I wrote down, you said it's an incredible backlog, all accountable to the pandemic. You have a very facile mind. We've heard about that a lot today. But I think that's overstating it. It is largely attributable to the pandemic. However, if this court makes a rule that says courtroom unavailability is a basis for excludable time, that is a rule that will persist long beyond COVID. So when the legislature fails to fill judicial vacancies and there are insufficient courtrooms, that would be excludable time.
So factor in the particular COVID-related problem that exists, and that is the limited number of facilities statewide that can accommodate all of the parties, witnesses, 12 to 16 jurors with social distancing.
Chief Justice, I recognize that, and I recognize that might present a different situation.
And what do we do with respect to that?
So respectfully, I think what the court must do is several things. The first thing is be explicit that this is not a limitation generally about the unavailability of courtrooms, but caused by social distancing, right? So as to not have this be a rule that persists long beyond COVID. Number two is to require the making of a specific record. There's been a lot of talk about what isn't in the record. But it's one thing to say, look, we've got a lot of cases and limited courtrooms, and your case is old but not the oldest, and therefore we can't do it. That's fine, but we need the real specifics. Your case is the 14th oldest case, and we can only do three trials at once, so therefore we think you'll be in the fourth cycle coming around. That sort of record is what is necessary. I think Ms. Lord referenced another thing, which is even when you make the finding that you'll be in the third cycle, and Justice Solomon, this was the inquiry, line of inquiry that you were going down, there shouldn't be a six-month delay. The case should be carried on a shorter term because, as we all know, cases do resolve. So of the 14, six of them may plead out or otherwise be resolved. And that, so you shouldn't give people trial dates that are very long down the road, though I don't know that it has to be carried every week, as you suggested, Justice Solomon. That might be even too much. And Chief, I think the other thing is the due process limitation, which we all agree exists, has to be real. It has to be meaningful, or else this can get out of control. And so the court was very clear in and right pretrial detainees that there is a due process right, but it has to be made meaningful. Ultimately,
okay, let's stay right there.
Sure.
What is meaningful? How do we assess that? What are the contours? What are the guardrails that you suggest?
So Justice Albin, I don't know that it needs to be suggested in this case. I think it will come before a due process challenge will come before this court. And having in and re pretrial detainees given permission for those challenges to exist, I think lower courts need to understand that. As Ms. Lert talked about, we are talking about presumptively innocent people and real damage to their lives when they're held. And so whether it's not about fault, right? The due process inquiry is not about whether it's the prosecutor's fault or the court's fault, or as we all can agree, nobody's fault, but it's not the defendant's fault. And the defendant...
So we need better records.
Without a doubt.
Because, what is the backlog in a county? Are there available courtrooms? Are they available with social distancing if we have those types of requirements? And as you were suggesting earlier, what's the oldest case on the list? What's the most serious case on the list? Those are the types of records that I think will be helpful when a court is analyzing what are the due process rights of a particular defendant.
I think that's right. And so when we think about constitutional speedy trial analysis, as opposed to statutory speedy trial analysis, it's a dichotomy. It's either the defendant's fault, this is under Barker and this court's line of cases, it's either the defendant's fault or it's the government's fault. And the government's fault doesn't mean the state, meaning the prosecutor, it means the state, it means the judiciary, and it means the legislature. So if it could at some point become a due process problem that there aren't the right the infrastructure isn't there. I don't think we're there. I don't think the court needs to decide it. But I think part of making all of this important is that the due process limitations have to be made meaningful. But I agree that the record is paramount. If I may move on to the prosecutorial readiness piece, Ms. Lord framed it as prosecutorial readiness is not static. I think that is exactly right. Justice Solomon, you, I think, kind of previewed what I would suggest the inquiry should be. Prosecutor stands up and says, Judge, I'm ready. And the judge would confirm a couple basic pieces of readiness. Madam Prosecutor, I assume that means that discovery is complete? Yes. I assume that means that you have no motions to be filed? Correct. I assume the indictment is in its finalized state. You're not about to seek a superseding indictment. Correct. And then just a slight quibble, Justice Solomon, where I think I'm actually taking a more state-friendly position. I don't think witnesses need to be subpoenaed for the prosecutor to indicate readiness. I think the prosecutor needs to indicate that they've spoken to their witnesses, they're generally available. But I don't think we want to set up a rule that incentivizes prosecutors to send out subpoenas they know will be meaningless. If they know the trial date isn't happening because there's no courtroom, I don't think we want them to subpoena them. However, we do need to know if, well, you know, the lead detective is now on military leave for the next 2 years. Whether they're subpoenaed or not, that makes them not ready for trial because they don't have their star witness. So those are the things that I think they have to do broadly on readiness. And the prosecutor must indicate that they or someone from their office, because unlike defense counsel, prosecutors can be more fungible, that they are available on the day they say it. So in this case, January 3rd, prosecutor says, I'm here, meaning I'm not on maternity leave, I'm not serving overseas, I'm here. On the subsequent trial calls, the prosecutor must also be able to indicate readiness. Now, I don't think we need to be unreasonable. That doesn't mean the prosecutor can't take a personal day, can't go to a funeral, can't go to the hospital. But if they're going to be away for an extended period, a week, something, that renders them no longer ready for trial unless they represent that someone in their office is prepared to try the case. That is, I think, the continuing obligation.
So that's the readiness component that comports with the statute I understand you were addressing.
Yes.
There's a practical concern as well. And that is that, obviously, you need the team to be ready, both sides of the aisle. And this is a concern that the AOC has been focused on, as well as the assignment judges. Sought-after counsel may not be able to show up. How does that factor into the analysis?
I wish I had a different answer, but I don't see how that wouldn't be a delay attributable to the defendant, the absence of defense counsel. And so that could potentially push it. I think what we have to address is the prosecutorial side. They must make themselves ready in one way or another if their point is the 2 years. Again, the 2 years can get extended by delays attributable to the defendant, but not by delays attributable to parties other than the defendant. Last point on appeals, I think it is in many ways the most critical one. This speedy trial becomes a right without a remedy if a motion for leave to appeal the denial of a speedy trial issuance in some way or another, excludable time, prosecutorial readiness, stops the clock. If it says, well, you're right, Mr. Defendant, there shouldn't have been excludable time granted for that, whatever it was, but you just filed your motion and therefore that grants excludable time, no one will appeal. And it becomes meaningless.
What's the answer? There's a motion to suppress. Listen to my question.
Okay, I apologize. Okay. It will be the last time I interrupt you, I promise.
I'm not counting on that. So there's a motion for leave to appeal made by you. It's granted, okay? And a little piece of your motion to suppress is successful, but the case is proceeding. It's not dispositive of the case.
Understood.
And like 9 months is gone. Maybe 10 months is gone. Let's say as a result of that, we're now at the 2-year mark. You don't want that cut off.
That's a delay attributable to the defendant, Jessica.
Oh, okay.
But I want to be very clear. This is a narrow exception that the Office of the Public Defender and the ACLU are asking for. Let me step back for a second. We opposed at the rulemaking stage, the idea that motions filed by the defendant in the ordinary course would count as either excludable time or delays attributable to the defendant. We still think as a matter of policy that that's bad. However, what we're asking for today is far more limited. It is appeals of speedy trial calculations. Because, Justice Albin, they do not delay the trial in any way. So they can't be a delay attributable to the defendant because they do not cause a delay. So the motion to suppress, even if not dispositive, changes the prosecutorial preparation. What is the universe of evidence that they have in the case? And until they know that, they can't be fully ready. But a speedy trial, the only thing that is affected by speedy trial determinations is the in-out question, right? It doesn't result in a dismissal of the indictment or an alteration of the evidentiary burden. All it does is say the defendant goes to trial as a free person or as an incarcerated person. Just for those motions by the state or by the defendant, because keep in mind, under Washington, the appellate division's holding says if the state appeals a speedy trial determination, it extends the time. I'm not suggesting there is gamesmanship being played by prosecutors in the state, but that is sure an invitation for it. We don't have enough time, so let's just file a motion for leave to appeal, and that would extend the time. So to me, the touchstone is, any motion directed to the trial court counts as a delay attributable to the defendant under this court's rules. But any motion directed to the appellate court that either imposes a stay on the proceedings, because that would be unfair, or alters the universe of available evidence. So be it a Miranda, a suppression of physical evidence, a Wade motion, all of those things would still count. But something like this, that does not slow down the proceedings below, should not be attributable to the defendant.
What happens, though, when that appeal regarding excludable time is pending when the two-year limit hits? The appeal's made, 2 years comes and goes, and the appeal's still pending to decide what is or is not excludable time. Does the defendant get released at that two-year limit?
If the prosecutor isn't ready, yes, because...
Let's assume they're ready. Everything's...
Oh, if they're ready, then the defendant doesn't get released, because that's the way the statute always works. You don't get released if the prosecutor is ready. But they get more than 2 years to be ready if there's a delay attributable to the defendant. And all I'm saying is they don't get the additional time to say they're ready because of an appeal that doesn't in any way affect their ability to be ready. And so, Justice Albin, to your question about repetitive motions, I don't see how they would cause a delay, but assume that there is a pro se litigant that is just filing motion after motion after motion, and the prosecutor at a certain point says, I can't ask the appellate section of my office to do it, I'm responding to these motions, then that would be a delay attributable to the defendant based on the frivolous nature of them. But we're not close to it, because right now the first motion is being counted against the defendant, which makes them, you might wonder why 7 years into the Criminal Justice Reform Act you're dealing with your first speedy trial case. In part, it's because of the disincentive defendants face to filing motions challenging speedy trial determinations.
How would you get there in light of the language of the statute?
Chief, I think the court has already several times in Rule 3:25-4I3 differed from B1F of the statute, right? There are all these substantive limitations in the court rule that are not found in the statute because the court is trying to effectuate the purpose of the statute. And so it's true, the statute says motions filed, but it's quite clear that if we're talking about delay and things that slow things down, we mean motions that will slow things down. And because this is not a motion that slows things down, it could be excluded by court rule. I think that is totally consistent with the separation of powers approach that the court has taken in drafting the speedy trial rules.
And the rule itself discusses the time it takes to render a decision on the motion and the mechanics of the court receiving replies and other things that would take place during motion practice in the regular course for suppression motions or anything other than a motion to appeal excludable time issues.
That's exactly right, Justice Pierre-Louis.
Anything you'd like to add?
There's not. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. White, I'm going to invite all amici to do their best to adopt arguments that have already been made. Please go ahead.
You took the words out of my mouth. I don't intend to address any of the issues that council has ably done so far. Instead, I'd like to speak to a mechanism. In this case, we heard about the November 15 trial date, strike that, November 15 hearing at which the court below, sua sponte, granted excludable time, both prospectively and retroactively. This keys into some of the questions that the court has asked here today. For instance, was there a basis for it? Is there a record? And I submit that had there been a hearing consistent with Rule 3:25-4C on the 180-day clock, those things would have been answered, and they would have been answered consistent with the due process requirements that apply to the deprivation of liberty in this case. One additional point, which is, if you follow modern literature, there's meta approaches to literature. It's a meta approach to mootness. The reason that it's meta is we're already talking about whether this case would be moot or not. I just wanted to emphasize the point that given the pervasive effect of COVID on thousands of defendants and on the entire judicial system, this case merits treatment as one that should still be reached because of its profound social effects. I thank you, and I also will take the opportunity to thank Justice Albert for his service.
Ms. Paskowitz.
May it please the court. From the state's perspective, this is a case where Judge Breland clearly found himself in a situation he did not wish to find himself in. He referred to as untenable and made a decision that was guided by this honorable court's previous findings that the COVID-19 pandemic was in fact extraordinary circumstances under the CJRA. And there are a number of issues that have been raised here today that the court has aptly noted could have been raised below, could have been challenged below, and were not. So from the state's perspective first, there is absolutely nothing in 2A162-22 or any other statute or the relevant court rule that prohibited Judge Breland from sua sponte, entering excludable time orders under the subsections that were memorialized in the court's two orders.
As long as they're grounded on a sound basis.
That's correct. And while I don't necessarily disagree that perhaps the record could have been lengthier, I don't know that there was any dispute, and it certainly wasn't challenged below what Judge Breland was referring to, both in September and in November, when he made multiple references to the situation we find ourselves in, the lack of courtroom availability. He specifically made references to the pandemic. At the time, Burlington County was trying one case at a time, criminal case, due to the need for social distancing and other safety measures. It's recently begun trying two criminal cases at a time. And certainly, defendant and the state never said, wait, what are you talking about, Judge? Why are we talking about courtroom congestion? Why are we talking about these extraordinary circumstances? And that was never really challenged below.
How about the superseding indictment?
The superseding indictment? I'm sorry.
Should weight have even been given to the superseding indictment? As a reason for somehow pushing the clock?
Respectfully, on this record, there was no weight given to it. The parties came in on November 15th, and while the state had returned a superseding indictment, and it's discussed by the parties, that factors not at all, factored not at all into Judge Breland's rationale. In fact, as Ms. Lord noted, both sides were surprised, as the record reflects, by the fact that the court had moved the trial date to April. But the court's rationale in doing so was entirely based upon exceptional circumstances and good cause for the pandemic. The court didn't reference at all the superseding indictment and entered its order sua sponte for that reason.
At the beginning of that proceeding, there's a discussion about the superseding indictment, and then the judge indicates that, and this is on page 4, pretrial detention will remain in effect and there will be excludable time, and that's when Ms. Lord begins questioning what's going on, because at the previous proceeding, wasn't it the case that Judge Breland had directed the state to file a motion with regard to excludable time that would have been returnable on that date? And that didn't happen.
It did not, but the state wasn't necessarily seeking excludable time at that point. It came to court prepared to address the superseding indictment.
The state wasn't seeking the time because of the superseding indictment.
Ostensibly, but then really for reasons completely unrelated to that initial conversation, the court enters the excludable time orders that deal with this new trial date. It's given due to court issues, not due to the superseding indictment.
Could the superseding indictment at that second conference in November have provided a basis for excludable time from what we know on the record?
Based on this record, it could have. It would, I think, respectfully, pursuant to DSW, that might have needed to be fleshed out more. But
no discussion about the factors set forth in the court rule. How different is it? Could this have been returned earlier? All of those things don't favor the state in this discussion. Would you agree?
I do agree. But I don't want to beat a dead horse. That was not what Judge Breland ultimately did. I don't want to speak too far outside the record, but Burlington County is updating its list of trials, aware of the situation constantly. And I think that's why you find in the record where Judge Breland actually says, I was advised the trial date is now April, because this list is being updated as constantly as possible. The movement of cases is being managed as quickly as it possibly can. And the court itself, the judge himself, was advised by criminal case management, which is tasked with trying to address this backlog that is certainly present not only in our county, but every other, in a way that's as expeditious and fair as possible.
Could a county prosecutor's decision not to use a virtual grand jury provide a basis for excludable time on the grounds of a superseding indictment that waited for an in-person grand jury?
I think that would have to be on a case-by-case situation, Your Honor. The record indicates that Burlington County was returning virtual indictments in many cases, but not in cases where there were concerns given the significance of the charges or potential information that they were uncomfortable disclosing remotely. But there's not a sufficient record here to make that argument.
So just to be clear, Bergen County was using the virtual grand jury for some cases in that period?
Burlington County did not at the very beginning use a virtual grand jury, but then did begin using a virtual grand jury. But as the assistant prosecutor noted in the record, this case was not presented virtually.
You're telling us the superseding indictment doesn't have anything to do with our discussion today?
No, it doesn't.
So does the January 3rd statement of readiness solve the problem from the state's perspective?
It does, Your Honor. And I think what defense counsel's arguments today did here from the state's perspective was conflate the issue of prosecutorial readiness as anticipated by the court rule and the statute with one of courtroom availability and scheduling. We all heard today that there are scheduling issues on both sides. We're here today. Counsel, who I understand certainly is a busy attorney, is in trial in another county, and the trial date has come and gone. And the state was ready. Counsel filed a motion on the 30th of March to sever the trial and indicates here today that her wish is that actually this defendant's case would go second.
We've heard suggestions from your colleagues across the aisle about what should be posed as questions to the prosecution when they say we're ready to go. What's your position on that?
My position is that as an officer of the court should be accepting that representation. I'm not sure why. There's certainly no support in the statute or the court rule for adopting a more onerous statute under the concept of what prosecutorial readiness was meant to be, which is a good faith representation that I have witnesses and can proceed to trial, and I'm not simply keeping a detained, for a case that we will never ultimately be able to take to trial. We don't have a good faith belief that we could prevail upon. We're not just simply keeping the defendant in and about to engage in a bunch of dilatory tactics. That's what prosecutorial readiness is. Not necessarily that on January 3rd, the state was ready to try the case, because even in September and November, the trial date wasn't January 3rd. It was later in January.
You heard the list that Mr. Shalom went through of questions that could be posed. Which, if any of those, do you consider onerous?
The legislation doesn't, I don't know if it's a matter of onerous, but simply why in this particular context an officer of the court's representation would be subject to more scrutiny than in any other context.
But the questions that he suggested were pretty simple. Is discovery complete? Is the indictment in its final form? I mean, those are pretty basic questions that I think any prosecutor preparing for a case or ready for a case should be able to answer, because prosecutorial readiness should suggest, okay, if a courtroom is available next week, you're ready to go. So a court accepting the representation that discovery is complete, witnesses are aware that the trial is coming and proceeding, and that the indictment is in its final form, I'm not understanding how those are difficult questions for a prosecutor handling a case to answer.
It's not necessarily that they're difficult, Justice. I think the issue becomes there are times that discovery could be complete as of January 3rd with what we know, but the state has an ongoing obligation to provide discovery, and discovery arises at all stages. Something could happen where there is a late discovered mistake in the indictment.
But as of the moment that the prosecutor is standing up in court and stating that they are ready to proceed to trial, they could make a representation that, yes, discovery is complete, with the caveat that we always have an ongoing obligation. I mean, that's always the case.
They could, but that's not something the legislature chose to include, any specific requirement that the state...
The legislature simply said the prosecutor is not ready to proceed. That's it. And the suggestion was, instead of just accepting the word, ask a few questions. How does that run counter to the language of the statute?
It doesn't necessarily, I guess, run counter to the spirit of the statute, but it concerns the state why we would distinguish this situation from any other.
Okay, so let me put it this way. You heard all the questions, okay, that were suggested by Mr. Shalom, right? Mm-hmm. You're willing to accept when the prosecutor says, I'm ready to go, that's a yes to all those questions. We can put that in the opinion. When the prosecutor says ready to go, the prosecutor is certifying to all those questions. You fine with that? That's good faith, no?
In good faith, yes. Subject, of course, to the fact that in individual cases, circumstances can always change.
Forget about the unforeseen, okay? The additional discovery. You heard the questions. When the prosecutor stands up and says, I'm ready, can we take it? That's a certification to all those questions. Yes. Discovery's done. Subject, obviously, to your continuing. You're ready. Your witnesses are ready to go. Is that good?
If that's what this court elects to do.
Well, Ms. Paskowitz, tell us what the harm is. That's what I'm not understanding here. If you say to a judge, the judge says we're starting 10 days from now on the Monday, and you say we're ready to go, that means your discovery is out. That means your witnesses will be ready to go. What's the harm in the additional probing, whether it's assumed or explicit, that gives you pause?
Only from the perspective, and I am beating a dead horse, that the assistant prosecutor trying the case is an officer of the court. If they're not prepared when push comes to shove, that's self-executing. They weren't prepared.
I'm not hearing any harm. Is that fair?
I guess not. But I think it's also noteworthy that this doesn't have to happen in New Jersey by way of a colloquy with the court. It also permits the state to do so in writing. So now we're respectfully delving even further afield where we're going to be making the state make additional representations in writing that weren't contemplated by the court rule or the statute. And how far is this going to go? It doesn't actually, the statute and the court rule don't require a specific inquiry by the court. It happened by inquiry by the court. They were in court on that date for that reason. But it can happen by a representation by the state on or before that date that can be made in writing or can be made in person. And it certainly does not, as suggested, simply because a defendant got to their two-year date where the states put their readiness on the record, that a release hearing is still required that's going to turn it into some sort of adversarial process about the state's readiness.
We understand your position. Is there anything else, other issues you'd like to address?
Briefly, I believe I've touched on these things, but as to the two-year issue, in this case, and I believe it was Justice Patterson who noted it, I think it's important to emphasize that these issues weren't really raised by defendant below. And there are any number of other ways a defendant who feels that his detention has been inappropriately extended or that he should no longer be detained, any number of mechanisms that already exist for addressing those issues. This is not a case where the defendant ever filed a motion to appeal his pretrial detention, a motion to reopen his detention, certainly under In re pretrial detainees. He automatically met the first prong of changed circumstances, having been detained for more than 6 months. And none of those things have happened. So it's difficult to come in now and say to this court, this terrible, gross due process violation occurred in January that I'm asserting now. I never went back to Judge Breland and asked him to reconsider. I never went back to Judge Breland and asked him to explain himself. In fact, counsel was there on January 3rd, and if this idea that the readiness the state put on the record was insufficient in any way, either by not properly being a present statement of readiness or by being insufficient for lack of factual detail, defendant had every right to say to Judge Breland at that point, this is insufficient, let me out. This is not a statement of present readiness, let me out. And I say that not to shift the burden to the defendant, but because I think anecdotally it shows how in this case, unusual circumstances aside, the state conceding that Judge Breland perhaps jumped the gun by in November, scheduling it in April, but the state remedying that by what occurred in January on the record. There's no basis for relief in this particular case, which is really what I'm here to address. And I would also note, I think that the issue of excludable time orders for appeals from excludable time orders, motions for leave to appeal from excludable time orders is perhaps an issue better addressed by the broad policy arguments of Amici. But I think it's not necessarily accurate to say there would never be a time when that could have an issue on how a case would resolve or how it would move forward. I think it can arguably cause systemic issues. There is a difference between, for the state and for defendant, between trying a detained defendant and a defendant who's out on the street. It might change the parties' respective positions as to what they're willing to resolve the case for. It might change when the court schedules cases. Counsel talked about, and I'm not aware of the numbers in Burlington County. I know that we've been trying cases on a very consistent basis as to whether more cases have been tried off the street versus detained and whether some have resolved or not. But of course all those things are impacted by excludable time that is or isn't attributable to that defendant and the party's knowledge that the case is proceeding in a certain way, and perhaps to the heart of the bigger issue that we're all here talking about today, which is this terrible situation we find ourselves in due to COVID, that it impacts what cases the state can be ready for trial. I know there's the belief that assistant prosecutors are more fungible. I would suggest that that is not always accurate, certainly not in cases of great significance. And in smaller offices where assistant prosecutors, like in this case, have been tasked with dealing with every aspect of a case from pretrial detention or shortly thereafter through trial. And yes, important liberty issues are at stake, and it's important that the people on both sides are prepared to address those at trial, because there are also important issues for victims and victim survivors. And it's not simply a matter of the state just, you know, throws somebody else in and starts trial and calls it a day.
I'm not suggesting there's any confusion on either side on this issue, but it's worth mentioning. The assignment judges, the criminal judges, have all been directed that detained cases are the priority. Those are the ones that should be tried. And that requires, set aside the act, that requires the cooperation of both sides of the aisle. Otherwise, the court's going to find a trial to present to the jurors that are present. But that is the ongoing directive that has come out from the court, from the AOC, to focus on detained cases. And that needs everyone's assistance in this. I want to ask one fact-specific question, if you would, and then Ms. Lord can answer this on rebuttal as well. The outer date in this case, the calendar date, is what? The two-year clock ended when?
January 3rd of 2022.
And that's assuming excludable time entered prior to that was all appropriate.
Well, as to the two-year clock, excludable time wouldn't really apply. So I delay attributable to the defendant would apply. And none was applied against him. The trial court didn't move the two-year date as to defendant when it entered the excludable time orders as to September and November. That was the two-year date.
Anything else?
Not unless Your Honor's wish me to address anything else.
Thank you, Ms. Pascoe.
Thank you.
We're going to try to finish this argument before we break for lunch. I'll say that to all counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. This case gives the court the opportunity to balance the legislative intent and the policy concerns of the CJRA with the practical effects of the unprecedented worldwide pandemic on our court system in two ways. First, by confirming that trial courts have discretion on their own to manage the 180-day trial clock based on COVID-related delays. And second, by confirming that the separate two-year prosecutor readiness clock stops when the prosecutor says on the record that, when the prosecutor says that they are ready for trial. When those statutory timeframes have been met, as they were in this case, there is no basis in the act, implementing rule, or case law to support releasing defendants for whom detention was previously deemed necessary based solely on the passage of time. Instead, remedies include what is already being done, namely assuring that the prosecutor is not being dilatory, allowing individual due process challenges, reopening detention hearings for those detained for more than 6 months because of COVID delays, and prioritizing the trials of detained eligible defendants. And then if I can just quickly discuss the notion that judges do not have discretion under the statute to manage excludable time on their own. Your Honors, that is completely contrary to the statute. The statute says that trial judges shall exclude time, and it lists what time frames shall be excluded. Only one of them include a motion of the prosecutor, and that is subparagraph G for the complexity factor. The inclusion of that subparagraph suggests that it shows that the court absolutely has discretion in all other cases, and that's the only actual basis that requires a motion. And practically, trial judges absolutely have to have this discretion just to manage their caseload in the wake of, you know, these COVID-related delays. So unless Your Honors have any questions, the Attorney General would urge the court to affirm.
Would you care to address the argument about the exclusion of time for an appeal?
Yes.
Specifically with respect to speedy trial, excludable time, et cetera.
So for the 180 days versus the two-year clock, there is a little bit of a difference. The 180-day trial clock excludes all delays, but the two-year clock does exclude only delays attributable to the defendant. So it's our position. We agree pretty much with the state that if there is a delay attributable to the defendant that, you know, causes trial not to proceed, then that is absolutely time that should be excluded.
How would that work in a case such as this?
Okay, so In this actual case, it's our position, we totally agree with the state, that the two-year clock has been satisfied. It was satisfied on January 3rd, so any other delay really would only go toward the 180, because the two-year clock has already been satisfied on January 3rd.
So then step back from the particular facts of this case. We come to the court for the almost two-year conference. Prosecutor says, ready to go. And defense counsel wants to take that up for any number of issues with respect to the speedy trial aspect. Excludable?
That is excludable. And I think the purpose of including excludable time in the statute was to account for these sorts of situations, to give courts flexibility. Because if it wasn't excludable, well, then that could invite a situation of gamesmanship where the defendant is just constantly appealing. And if there is no effect on those on those time frames, well, then the defendant would have to be released when the state's powerless to stop that.
What if objectively looking at the record at the appellate level, it's threadbare, and the trial judge was simply wrong. Good faith mistake, but dead wrong, and the defendant had the winner of the argument. Excludable?
If the judge excluded time and he was wrong for doing so and the defendant appealed, I think, Your Honor, I think it is still excludable because it's, you know, all the time motions are broad and parties argue, and just because maybe on appeal they weren't correct, that doesn't mean that it was a reasonable delay. And if it was brought by the defendant, then that's provided for in the statute.
Does that raise a practical problem of you don't know ultimately the merits of the appeal until potentially it goes to this court?
Absolutely.
So there may be a long delay before everyone is aware of whether or not this was a good motion with a strong position or not.
There could be, but even with the two-year clock, I'm being satisfied that the defendant still has a 180-day clock to protect him. And I think there's a basis. I don't know that every single excludable time order has to be appealed. I think if they're calculating, because they're supposed to calculate time as well under the rule, if they're calculating time as earlier than what's listed on eCourts, I don't see why they couldn't make a motion at that point and say, here, Judge, this is how I calculated the time. Defendant should be released, and they could appeal that way, and that way it kind of if I'm remembering correctly, it would save the problem of appealing each and every one. But if excludable time is not attributable to the defendant when they're appealing, it can only invite gamesmanship.
One last issue for me. With respect to superseding indictments, does there need to be a stronger statement to prosecutors about timeliness of superseding indictments that relate directly to the original charges, based on your vantage point in the Attorney General's office?
There does not need to be a stronger statement regarding superseding indictments, and here's why. The rule appropriately covers that, and the Appellate Division published opinion in State v. DFW certainly covers that as well. The rule, I think it's Rule 325-4F, lists the factors, and the rule adds that trials shall be set as soon as reasonably practicable, and then list factors to be taken into consideration in scheduling that time. So the defendant is certainly protected by that rule and those time frames, but the statute does say that time shall be excluded for the superseding indictment. So that could mean one day, that could mean more days. I will say, in this case, to the extent the prosecutor below said that we automatically get an extra 180 days, that is incorrect. That's against the statute and the rule, but it has no actual effect in this case because the judge's excludable time orders here that the court is reviewing had nothing at all to do with the superseding indictment. That was a side conversation that is confusing the issues, but really the judge's ruling had nothing to do with that. So it's our position that the rule and State v. DFW appropriately considers that question. So at this point, there's really no need for guidance on that issue, especially because the orders here had nothing to do with that.
Questions? Anyone? Anything you'd like to add? Thank you. I see you grabbing your pad. Mr. McNamara.
May it please the court, on behalf of the County Prosecutors Association, I join in everyone today thanking Justice Altman for his service And on a personal note, when you refer to spirited questioning, at one particular point in my career, as I was leaving this courtroom, one of the state troopers who guard the courtroom pulled me inside and asked me if you and I had a beef from the old neighborhood. And I responded, I was not aware of any, nor do I certainly feel or harbor any of those feelings, but I will leave that as it may. I join in my colleague, Mr. Shalom's universal sort of 30,000-foot viewpoint that the County Prosecutors Association is taking on this particular case in light of it being the first opportunity for the court to interpret some of these provisions. So if I may, I'd like to just address the readiness portion. We accept the representation of the Burlington County Prosecutor that their assistant prosecutor did, in fact, answer ready. And the County Prosecutors Association believes that the statute requires the prosecutor to satisfy the readiness requirement as an engine that would drive the system, that you cannot have a trial if the prosecutor is not ready. But it is not equivalent to a trial has to be tried within 2 years. That's not the legislative text. What we submit that this court can certainly find and be consistent with the court rule, be consistent with our constitutional obligations as prosecutors, that a good faith statement of the capability to try the case with sufficient evidence to sustain the burden of proof is what the standard would be for prosecutorial readiness. I do not think there was an issue following up on some of your questions regarding a limited inquiry as to the contours of that, but I do think if the court is discussing or providing guidance to trial courts regarding the inquiry, there has to be some limiting principles regarding that. First, we would run into the issue of a judge substituting their own judgment for the executive branch as to what ready means. I think the good faith pronouncement of our assistant prosecutors should be sufficient. With discovery, I do think there has to be some sort of limiting language or some capability to cabin the idea that a subsequent discovery, a particular piece of paper, a particular piece of note, a piece of discovery that was to be turned over in time for trial would not necessarily eviscerate a prior declaration of readiness. Because if you look at our court rules, I can think of at least three circumstances in any case that I've tried, and I tried over 100 before I transitioned to appellate work. If I speak to a witness the night before they testify and I take a note under this court's jurisprudence, I have an obligation to turn that over. Under our identification court rules, any time I say to a witness, do you remember, did you see this person? Is this the person that you saw? If I confirm a one-on-one identification photo the night before trial prep, I have an obligation to turn that over. So the Prosecutors Association is not worried about inquiries from the court.
No, I don't think anyone has in mind those types of things that you can't know at the time that you're saying the case is ready. But do you agree with Mr. Shalom's statements, assuming no inquiry? When you say you're ready, it means got witnesses who are ready to testify.
Witnesses are identified, absolutely.
Right, and
the discovery that had to go out has gone out.
A substantial portion, a material portion, the type of amount of discovery that if I was trying a case, that'd be prepared. But the understanding is,
Let me say it in plain English. The discussion is not about creating a gotcha situation.
And that's why, and I heard terms like the prosecutor would be certifying, and we would have concerns about. The good faith representation is, I think, what one of the questions was. If I stand up as a prosecutor and say, I am ready to try this case, then the judge, with every piece of authority, should count on, okay, counsel, we're going to get a courtroom tomorrow. You're ready to go. The problem that I see and the problem that the County Prosecutors Association hopes that this court recognizes is that the two-year clock is different than the 180-day clock. That once we do declare readiness within that two-year system, we have satisfied the legislative intent that we have combated some portion of dilatory tactics or some portion of potential systemic delay that only the prosecutor can control. I don't think the two-year clock then resurrects. I don't think the state has to be in a constant state of readiness. Once we declare our readiness within that two-year time period, that portion of 162-22 is satisfied. However,
what do you mean you don't have to be in a constant state of readiness? I mean, if the case is scheduled for January 22nd, and the court says can't do it on the 22nd. We're going to put it to the 29th.
I've declared readiness, and when I'm making my good faith representation on the 22nd, I have satisfied the two-year clock, because I think readiness is different than availability. And I think that is a distinction that is clear within the statute. The difference is, and I think the protection still remains, the 180-day clock, which requires commencement of trial, still runs, that will still be providing protection, will still be providing impetus to the system to go forward. But once the state makes a good faith statement that I am capable of trying this case with sufficient evidence to satisfy my burden of proof, a typical case, my forensic information is complete, the state is saying to the court, if we're available, we're ready to go. Because I think that's what the legislative history indicates what this particular two-year clock was.
I think we have your position on this point. What else would you like to address?
On the issue of the appeal, I think I just want to point out a couple things from a practical standpoint. One, I think a lot of the litigation and a lot of the context the court should be aware of is sort of just the mechanics of how these cases are being tracked and traced at the trial level. Based upon the e-court system and the system that was put in place by the AOC, the court at the time of the adjournment has to indicate whether the time is includable or excludable. And then there's an automatic clock that's generated that the parties use, that's available through e-courts, that the public can access. And, as the case gets closer to deadlines, the numbers turn red. That doesn't necessarily mean, and the cases that you're concerned about interlocutory appeal of release determinations, that's a binary determination. Either somebody's clock has run out or has not. So these adjournments that might be considered to be excludable, there's no real need to rush for interlocutory review to the appellate division, because ultimately the issue is whether or not the entire time has run. And at that particular point, if the entire time has run, the statute's not self-executing, a judge will make a ruling, you're to be released or not to be released. And then the statutory text is clear. Motions are excludable under the statute, under the 180-day clock. And, going back to Aquinas, the first cause is the cause of the chain. If a defendant then chooses to seek appellate review, it's attributable to the defendant. However, the idea of this is a crippling issue that defendants are languishing because of pretrial detention appeals. One, the state has an obligation still to go forward to be ready. That clock will immediately commence once we have an opinion. Clearly, in the issue of interlocutory appeals relating to evidence and going back to tying it back to readiness, to be frank, if I have a case and I have my evidence and there's a motion to suppress, I'm assume I'm going to win it. That shouldn't impact my ability to answer ready. I'm going to assume I'm going to win. Likewise, if a case is on appeal, an interlocutory appeal, I assume the state's going to believe that it's going to sustain its burden to prove a particular piece of evidence should be admissible, or that a trial court may have committed error if we seek review. The final thing I'd like to just point out is, and there were some questions, April the 26th, 2022 may not be the proper time to determine whether or not general court congestion falls within the good cause exception to the speedy trial rules. I would point out our legislature did not adopt the language similar to the federal system that excludes general court congestion. But I also recognize New York and the federal authority, it's a dismissal remedy as opposed to a release remedy. But clearly now we're still under the auspices of a gubernatorial declared public health emergency. This court's omnibus orders relating to social distancing are still required to be followed by all the counties. The Prosecutor's Association did point out the numbers as of March relating to the number of detention cases. We recognize that. And I think it's important to close on, delay is not the friend of a trial prosecutor representing the state of New Jersey. This idea that prosecutors are somehow using this time to some sort of have a benefit just doesn't hold up to scrutiny of reason and logic.
On that point, in light of your experience, and you've been in front of the court many times, so you know this is a question seeking your input. Has the current situation contributed to delays in extending reasonable plea offers?
No. In fact, it's the opposite. I think the from the moment of the first gubernatorial executive order 103 through the litigation regarding the order to show cause, the pretrial detention issues, the state has recognized an obligation to try to limit the jail population and to make plea offers. The Attorney General, I don't speak for the general, but there have been directives regarding plea bargaining that the system should go forward. Although some of the prosecutors, as this court's aware in the state versus Dangzil, expressed some reluctance regarding a pure virtual grand jury system. The grand jury system never was completely shut down once this court determined that it was enough for at least to begin the preliminary steps of back to normalization once we got through the surges. I can represent to the court the numbers I cited to the court in March are not as high as they are as of yesterday, not to a great statistical significance, but the number of pretrial detainees is down, the number of detainees who've been held more than 6 months is down, and the two-year number is down. Not a tremendous piece, but I can represent to the court. I know, especially in Morris County, which not historically had large trial numbers, it was just the nature of our particular practice that it wasn't necessarily a trial county. We've had assistant prosecutors and trials going every trial day, as far as I can remember, for at least since we went back live and allowed jurors into the building.
So let me ask this question. Has the failure of the political branches to fill vacancies on the bench contributed to delays from your perspective?
I'm reaching my 25th year on August 1st, so I will answer that question. Right. Absolutely. The reality is I can answer ready for trial, but I can't summon jurors. I can't pick a courthouse. I can't have a judge available. In theory, I can answer ready for a trial today, and the court can say, we're going to start this case in 3 weeks, but then we worry about bringing jurors in and the availability of jurors. Listen, there is obviously...
Okay, so the lack of judges because of the failure of vacancies to be filled is a contributing factor?
Going back to my Aquinas, I'm not sure if it's space versus judges or judges versus space. I think obviously that is tangential. I know in many counties, as this court's aware, there's litigation with the political branch relating to courthouse facilities and building new courthouses. It's a extraordinarily complicated issue.
Right. So assume, but for the sake of my question, that the pandemic is no longer the problem, or space, but the failure of the political branches to fill this. The bench with judges. Should that be a factor in a due process?
I would say, well, let me first say from a pure legal textual standpoint, I think court congestion does fall within the good cause exception of the excludable time 180-day clock. I think the exceptional circumstance exception, clearly in the auspices of a public health emergency and the waning days of it, hopefully waning, might not be the necessary lever for excludable time. Clearly, good cause is a piece, and the legislature did not impact and did not request and did not enact a general court congestion exception. The due process test, which Your Honors indicated in pretrial detainees, the length of detention in and of itself under the 14th Amendment and our own state constitutional provision is not enough. There is certainly many factors and facets that go into a due process analysis that clearly this record is not near robust to have that important conversation. And to be frank, I have not done a deep enough dive to other than indicate due process is an outer limit. I don't think we've reached that outer limit. I don't think we'll ever reach that outer limit, to be frank, with the hard work that everyone in the system is trying to do to get back to normalcy and try these cases. But right now, where we are as of today, a good faith representation by the state that they are ready satisfies the two-year clock. And
I think we've covered the issue.
And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ms. Lord.
to answer perhaps some of the questions of recent counsel, the question, does the current situation, has that assisted in extending reasonable plea offers? I respectfully disagree. It has not. The only thing I reasonably believe and reasonably suggest would assist.
Sir, can you slow down a bit? I know you're rushing to get finished.
But. I am rushing because I saw the time, but I will slow down. I apologize. In my humble opinion, the only thing that will result in reducing this backlog, which, i.e., giving reasonable plea offers, is real trial dates. You have to have real trial dates.
We're well aware of that and working toward that goal, along with all of you.
Okay. The second aspect of the suggestion by the county prosecutor somehow that we should have done more to get out of jail flies in the face of the act. I mean, we were all excited to read In Re Detainees. Oh my goodness, I can't tell you how many motions I filed. P.S., ask me how many I want. P.S., ask me how many more days my clients found themselves in jail because I filed a motion. And then I had the audacity to file appeals, which I lost leave on. I bought clients 6-7 months in jail sometimes because I was doing it over and over again. I mean, it's just fundamentally unfair to put it at the feet of a defendant who is not responsible for anything. Thirdly, the January 3rd is the 2-year release date to answer the court's question. And finally, getting back to the superseded indictment aspect, you have to look at on September 17th, we weren't superseded yet. The prosecutor was asking for excludable time. Judge said brief it. We come back November 15th. There's no brief. Nobody's asking for excludable time, but the only difference between September and November is we have a superseding indictment, and the state takes a position on the record they believe wrongly, as conceded by the state in today's argument, that they're entitled to restart the clock all over again. Certainly it had to have taken to some consideration with respect to why the judge did what he did. It just has to. It's an inescapable inference, I would suggest. The what this court has, the responsibility is awesome with respect to all of the pretrial detainees that are currently awaiting trial at the present time. I personally have 79 defendants awaiting trial in jail. To suggest somehow that a defendant should do more to get himself out of jail is just untenable. There has to be real outer limits. There has to be real trial dates. There has to be real commitment. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter.